Hi, and welcome to one of our House of Comments summer podcast specials. I'm Emma Burnell, author of the Labour-supporting Scarlet Standard blog. We're recording a few specials over the summer to make sure that you've got something to listen to while we take our holidays. I am delighted to be joined today by Isabel Hardman, who is the editor of the Spectator's Coffeehouse blog. Hello, Isabel.
Hello.
Thank you very much for joining me today. We're going to talk about something I know far less than you do, so this is a bit more you than me, and the sort of the general state of the Tories and how they're feeling at the moment. They seem to be going into the summer on a bit of a high. Do you think they're right to?
I think largely they are right to. They've had lots of good news recently, not just the sort of economic green shoots, you know, unemployment going down, crime going down, things that they can claim credit for, even though they've got sort of much wider, many wide factors going into them. They have gone off on a good note. Labour's in quite a weak position at the moment, and that always cheers parties in government when the opposition is having a tricky time, because it takes the heat off them.
Mm.
A little bit. There's always the danger of complacency. These are economic green shoots. We're not back into the sort of golden days or anything like that. And the big worry that I have really is that actually voters don't feel like there are green shoots. You know, in Westminster, we feel there are because we have the ONS site on our bookmarks and that sort of thing. And we're in the London bubble, where in London, actually, particularly in central London, it's very difficult to notice any downturn at all. Whereas in the rest of the country, a lot of towns and cities still feel like they're very much in recession.
Mm.
So actually, there's a disconnect issue where politicians are sort of tweeting from their constituencies today saying, it's a wonderful day in my constituency, everything's going fine. And actually, a lot of their constituents might not be feeling like that. But, you know, the polls aren't looking bad for the Tories either. Labour's poll lead could be much better. In some cases, obviously, Labour's poll lead disappeared in one poll this week. And if that proves not to be an anomaly, then that's going to be a serious problem for the party. So there's plenty of reasons to be cheerful if you're a Tory MP at the moment.
I mean, it must be a nice place to be, because they haven't had that for a while. There was quite
indeed.
Over the last year. Do you think that will resurface, or do you think the discipline's back on as we swing into pre-election period?
Yeah, I think the self-whipping theory that actually Tory MPs will stop bickering and stop rebelling as they near an election, I think that does carry quite a bit of weight. But there is one significant problem on the horizon. Even if we continue to get good economic data, the European elections are going to be a real time of trouble for the Tories. UKIP do seem to be having their own poll blip at the moment. But if they do well in the European elections, as we're all expecting, then that's going to put the pressure back on David Cameron from Tory backbenchers, who sort of will see this as proving every theory they've ever had about how the party needs to move to the right and all that sort of thing. So he's got time to prepare. He's got time to prepare a strategy. He's already been briefing Tory MPs on what he thinks about UKIP in general, about what he and Linton Crosby want to do with UKIP. But they maybe need to set out what their specific UKIP strategy is for the European elections, just so that the whole party feels like it's on a war footing, rather than that it's, you know, going to really suffer and struggle when we actually get to polling day in 2014.
And is it possible for some of our Conservative MPs to really feel like they're on a war footing against UKIP, when quite a few of them are quite keen on being more friendly towards them?
Yeah, I think the UKIP pact nattering has gone quiet for a little while, actually. It will resurface before the European elections, that I have no doubt. I think there will be some Tory MPs who will get very spooked by what happens in their area in particular, and will start campaigning for a pact. Now, a pact would be a bad idea, but that doesn't mean that Cameron won't come under sustained pressure to have something. And the problem is that the Tory leadership, it's very difficult for the Tory leadership to condemn an idea and for it to go away. I mean, don't forget, they condemned the idea of an EU referendum, and look how much has changed since that position back in 2011. So Tory MPs now think that if they push hard enough and for long enough, they'll get what they want. So we may well see those on the sort of UKIP wing of the party really pushing for this if they start getting panicked.
There have been a number of sort of ginger groups springing up, as far as I can tell. There was the Alternative Manifesto,
yeah.
Alternative Queen's Speech, rather.
Yep.
And then the 40 marginals manifesto.
Yep.
Some ideas perfectly sensible for Tories, some ideas maybe slightly less so.
Yeah, I think not surprising ideas, though, from the alternative Queen's speech came from Peter Bone and Philip Hollabone here. None of the ideas they brought up were a particular surprise coming from those two MPs. I mean, I know lots of people in Downing Street and who are sort of intimately involved in the party's real strategy had their heads in their hands. They were sort of thinking this will get far more attention than anything sensible we're doing with the personal tax allowance or anything like that. But, you know, I suppose that's what happens in all parties. There are parties, in every party there is a wing of backbenchers who have these sort of potty ideas and who think it's a good idea to get them out there, because if only people listen to them, then, you know, if they'd have a majority Conservative government. You see that in Lib Dems, you know, they often produce some quite interesting things at conference that everyone else laughs at and Paul Nick Clegg has to sort of, you know, try and extricate himself from.
Which of course gets him in a lot of trouble because they're supposed to have this democratic...
Yeah, exactly. At least the Conservative Party is a little bit more authoritarian when it comes to its policy making. I mean, I think now's the sort of ideas time. And actually, aside from some of the more interesting alternative Queen's speech ideas, there is some really good thinking going on in the party. So some of the 40 groups' ideas were very sort of emblematic rather than... I mean, I have to say... I'm always slightly uneasy when people start talking about benefits for teenage mums and that kind of thing. So we don't have that many teenage mums. And actually, a lot of the proposals they were talking about were the sorts of things that are happening already. You know, if you're a teenage parent, you do tend to stay at home with your own parents because you don't know what you're doing, or you may go into a centre that helps you if you're a bit chaotic. So in the same way as, you know, there's that sort of, we will stop social housing going to foreign nationals. Well, actually, not much social housing goes to foreign nationals. It's one of those sort of myths that MPs like to wheel out every so often to sound populist as much as anything else. But there's David Skelton, former Deputy Director of Policy Exchange, has launched his campaign group Renewal, which is, I suppose, a reasonably centrist campaign group to try and win back voters outside the Tory heartlands. And some of the things that he wants the party to talk about are actually issues that Tories have tried not to talk about for too long. So having a genuinely positive offer for those on low wages, rather than just saying, no, you can't raise the minimum wage, and then trying to close down discussion thereafter. So it's encouraging to see that there's some good thinking going along, as well as the wacky thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the David Skelton group is something that's attracted interest from all sides. Certainly, I think if Labour felt that it was being taken seriously enough and actually being adopted into policy, it would be something that would make for interesting campaigning, because I think there would be more agreement than there would be disagreement on some issues.
Yeah.
Which doesn't seem to be the way that the Tories are acting at the moment. You mentioned Linton Crosby earlier, and it certainly seems that one of the reasons the Tories are going out on a high is because they have come together to bash Labour as hard as possible.
Yeah, definitely.
And that seems to be the way that they've decided to make the running.
Yeah. So they had a meeting about a month ago where Crosby said, we're going to take the fight to Labour, and the way we're going to do that is by portraying Ed Miliband as being very weak. And that, you know, that does seem to be working, not just for Tory party morale, but it also seems to be a line that is catching on. I mean, I think Ed Miliband, to his credit, has responded pretty quickly to the union row that's been rumbling on. But it also, it's been an absolute gift to the Tory party. And again, another boost for them, because quite a lot of them love a good union bashing session.
They do. But that's kind of against what David Skelton and Robert Halfen have been trying to do, which is kind of trying to open up those people who are engaged through their union, who aren't necessarily Labour supporters.
Yeah, their own sort of Hugger McCluskey strategy, where actually you separate out the union bosses from the union members, and you say, well, the union bosses aren't representing their frequently Tory voting members, particularly Well, I think people like David Skelton and Robert Halford are so thoughtful, and they don't just accept sort of orthodox thinking, which is very easy in tribal politics to do, just to listen to what other people are saying and think, I believe that as well, without really examining your own convictions. Mm. And because of that, they quite often get accused of being left-wing. I mean, Halfon's always being accused of being a Lib Dem or a closet Labour supporter, when actually many of the things he believes put him to the right of the party. It's just he likes to articulate himself properly and he likes to think things through. There's nothing really particularly, it's not really that he's being particularly lefty and saying, I believe that trade unions should, you know, restrict the labour market being reformed, that sort of thing. All he wants to do is to be able to communicate with union members. Mm. And that's not a particularly left-wing thing.
No, I would agree with that. I think there is sometimes some fairly unthinking oppositionalism of all sides, but certainly, just to say, we're recording this on the 19th of July, at the end of a week where there has been a rather bizarre conversation about whether left or right wingers are evil. Are you evil, Isabel?
I'm deeply evil. I wake up every morning thinking, how on earth can I ruin poor people's lives? I mean, this debate has been, it's been hilarious, but I think also actually, even though there's been a huge amount of faux outrage on the part of right wingers, if we were going to take a lesson from this, I think the right wing of our politics does still need to think about its language, because sometimes right wingers can appear lacking in compassion in a way that is entirely inaccurate, but because they often want to make hard-headed economic arguments and they maybe, you know, want to reform the labour market to make it more flexible and that sort of thing, their efforts to do what they think is right to increase employment and to give people freedom from the state can often come across as quite unthinking and uncaring, when often they're anything but. I mean, I'd say probably one of the most socially conscious people I've worked with is my boss Fraser, who's very right wing and who's you know, very free market, but actually he is much better than a lot of right wingers at communicating what's good for sort of people who are vulnerable and disadvantaged, whereas I think some other right wingers do tend to sort of miss that step out, and they don't talk about social justice in an engaging way, which makes people on the left who maybe don't pay that much attention to the right wing of politics just assume that right wingers don't care. But it's been one of those sort of hot summer's day debates, hasn't it?
Yeah,
people
absolutely.
Getting very angry and writing angry replies. I think the best blog I read on it was Mark Ferguson's blog on Labourlist, actually. He wrote this
absolutely.
Very thoughtful
I
piece.
It was excellent.
Yeah, I thought he kind of had the last word in a debate that was starting to become a little bit silly. I mean, it was obviously silly from the beginning, but it got even sillier.
Absolutely.
The week
no, I thought Mark was spot on.
Yeah.
And I think it's just unhelpful to try and stop a debate. If you say someone's evil, then you say you can't beat their arguments. It's an ad hominem attack rather than a, this is why you're wrong in what you're doing. I mean, I, for example, am a huge, huge campaigner against the bedroom tax because I think it's a terrible idea, a terrible policy. But I don't think it's an evil policy. I think it's a misguided policy.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah,
and then that's that. You know, there are good arguments against it that you miss out if you simply miss the step of arguing against the policy and simply say it's being driven by bad intentions.
Yeah, but I think it's a real challenge for people on the. I mean, when I was at university, I thought I was left wing because lefty people speak a language of compassion, and if you're interested in social justice, that language is very attractive. And when you actually examine the policies and the stances, I mean, in my case, I realized that I agreed with the language but disagreed with the substance, which meant I sort of started looking elsewhere. But I do think that if the right want people who are swing voters but who are interested in justice and compassion, they do need to sometimes moderate their language, in the same way as sometimes left wingers can wrongly be accused of being stupid because they make emotional arguments. I think there's sort of lessons on both sides there, aren't there?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I completely agree. I think that's quite, and I think it is a danger, and I think it was something that Theresa May brought up some time ago when you know, when she was talking, not that the Tories are the nasty party, but they're perceived as the nasty party.
Yeah.
And that's quite an easy perception for them to fall into.
Yeah, I think some of their MPs don't help. I mean, Aidan Burley, for instance, is an MP who loves to bash trade unions, who tweeted this time last year that the Olympics opening ceremony was full of multicultural crap.
Yes.
I mean, I think some people might have agreed, might now agree with what he said about the NHS. But the problem is that he is the sort of unreformed Tory that people think of, when actually most Conservatives are very thoughtful, passionate people who want the best for their constituents and are often horrified. They're going to politics and for the same reasons that Labour people go into politics. Mm. They're horrified by the sort of the crappy lives that some people are forced to lead by bad government policies. So, I mean, I was talking to someone in CCHQ who said that if the Conservatives fail to get a majority at the next election because Aidan Burley has lost his seat, then there'll be a sort of a price worth paying, basically.
The anti-Chris Patton approach, then.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
I mean, going back to that, in terms of, you know, the Tories are feeling buoyant, but they are still 8 points behind, roughly, in the polls. It is very hard for a governing party to increase its majority, to increase its votes at an election. If I could put you on the spot, what do you think the outcome of the next election will be?
Well, I think trailing behind the opposition party in the midterm by only 8 points isn't a bad place to be, because at the moment people are bored and they'll just say, yeah, I'd vote for Labour because I'm annoyed with this policy and that policy, not because I think Labour necessarily are attractive, just because I think the grass is greener on the other side. So I think the Conservatives currently think that that polly will vanish when people's minds are focused by the appearance of a ballot box, and that actually they'll suddenly find themselves back in a much better position. Personally, if I had to put money down, I'd probably go for another hung parliament with the Conservatives and Lib Dems going into coalition again, which would make my life as a political journalist very interesting, because I think the Tories would then ditch David Cameron and go into a turmoil which is entirely baffling to voters, but which is entirely justified, because actually they won't have won an election for a very, very long time. Yeah. And they will be under a prime minister who has failed to win twice. So at that stage, they would start to want another leader. And knowing the party as I do, I expect they'd probably go for a right-wing new leader as well, which would make coalition with the Lib Dems absolutely fascinating, because Cameron is instinctively centrist on most issues, which makes it quite easy to get on with Nick Clegg, who is also instinctively centrist.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very interesting. I think if there were to be a hung parliament, it would probably strengthen Nick Clegg's position, which makes it harder for him to work with Labour.
Yeah,
and weaken if it were a Tory Lib Dem coalition, weaken David Cameron, which would make it harder for Nick Clegg if they did replace him with a right winger. So I think Nick Clegg is going to be in a, if there is a hung parliament, it's not clear that Nick Clegg is going to have an easy ride of it, because both of those outcomes make things hard for him.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
I think my opinion at the moment is that it'll be slightly the other way round. I think we'll get either a Labour government with a small majority or a Labour's largest party, and we'll see what happens in the negotiations.
That'd be interesting. Yeah, yeah. That would be very interesting to see whether they make Nick Clegg's head the price of a coalition as
well.
Yeah,
I mean, I think personally that would be, for me, it would be a red line, because they certainly did that to Gordon Brown.
Yep.
And I think if the Lib Dems lose seats, it will be seen as a rejection of Clegg's bargain with the Tories. So yeah, it's very difficult to keep him in power.
Yeah.
But you couldn't get rid of all of the leading Lib Dems who've been part of the coalition. So you would have to have some of the key players with whom Labour are least keen as part of any coalition government. So
who do you think that would, because I can't imagine them wanting to work with Danny Alexander.
I can't imagine them to work with Danny Alexander or David Laws or Jeremy Brown.
Yeah.
All of whom are leading lights in the Lib Dems. It depends who still has their seats.
Yes, well, that's another problem. And actually the left the lefty Lib Dems are not in the ascendancy in the party. I mean, apart from Cable, who is not as Lib Dem, he's not as lefty as everyone thinks he is on lots of things. Vince Cable's the only really prominent left-winger in the party. The others are much lower down, and some have shifted. You know, Simon Hughes has moved towards the centre since since being elected, and I can't really see him going into government with Labour either because of the tussle over tuition fees. I think there's still sort of a fair amount of bad blood there.
Yes, and then that is the other problem that Labour has, is that during the election campaign, whatever else happens, it'll be 2-1 in terms of defending the last 5 years.
Yeah. Who'd you go for?
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, I think it's certainly interesting. Maybe we should have a little bet, you and I, see if we can see who wins.
Who wins? Yeah, I'd be up for that. Although I'm not going to put too much money down because I still think it's all to play for at the moment.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think we know yet. I think we can make our informed guesses, but we certainly couldn't claim to have any really clear path to any new government.
No, and if you think about this stage for the Labour government, actually, it was becoming pretty obvious that it was dying by this stage. There were, you know, it was the limping signs were already here. I'm just trying to think back to, so if we're in 2013 now, then
2008.
Yeah, so actually things were looking all right at this time in 2008, but they started to get hairy pretty quickly from then on. So things might start to crystallise, or actually it may still be all to play for at the start of 2015, which will make life really exciting.
Yes, and you know, as Labour sort of start to develop the new policies that our millions of policy forums have been working on secretly in the dark for quite a long time, maybe we will come up with our own emblematic policies that appeal. I mean, and certainly that's my hope.
I think actually Ed Miliband, I know his big economic week didn't work out that well in terms of, you know, he didn't suddenly get a massive poll lift, but although I don't think he was expecting to dramatically change Labour's fortunes. But I think in terms of the way the party reacted to his big economy week, where actually they did make some tough admissions on spending and on welfare, the party could have gone into orbit, but it didn't. And I think that's really a tribute to Ed Miliband and the work that he's done to make his backbenchers feel personally invested in him, that there has been open warfare. And there may not be the open warfare we've been expecting. There's been open warfare on the unions, so it's often the sort of, you know, events that crop up.
But even on the unions, actually, there's been more.
There's been internal
unity than I was expecting. I thought there would be much, much bigger turmoil, but actually, people have come together and said, "Yes, okay, this is the right thing to do."
Yeah.
One of the things that the union decision does do is put pressure back onto the Tories in terms of their own funding. Do you think that they will agree to a cap?
Well, they don't seem very keen on it at the moment. They keep saying that a cap would lead to state funding of political parties. Obviously, everyone seems to forget that we already have state funding in the form of short money. But obviously, this would be of a much bigger order. I don't know. I think in terms of the politics, no party benefits from talking about funding because everyone's got slightly grubby arrangements and sort of promises behind closed doors and that sort of thing that make the public feel very uneasy. So the sooner they could do a deal, the better for all concerned, really, because we just don't want lengthy discussions in Parliament about how parties are funded, because the Lib Dems, who like to sort of be the pure ones in politics, they've got their own donor problems, haven't they?
But absolutely.
So hopefully strategists will go away this summer and think about what they can actually do. All the signs at the moment, unfortunately, are that there's not going to be a party funding deal before the general election. The talks seem to have reached a real deadlock. But if one side wants to keep the pressure up in Parliament, that doesn't benefit anyone, actually.
Even though Ed has accepted the union cap and the changing of the opt-in, which I think was the Tories' biggest sort of, that was what they always said they wouldn't go for the cap while that was happening. I think it does allow Labour to come out of this discussion better than they were.
Yeah, no, I really have to give credit to Ed Miliband for what he's decided to do. I think, you know, these are big reforms, sort of clause 4 style reforms. that will lose the party a lot of money. And actually, the difference between this and Clause 4 is that Clause 4 was a response to a new reality, whereas Ed Miliband is changing the reality himself. He's not accepting, as Labour had to do, that public ownership of everything was a good thing, because so many things had come out of public ownership by the time we got to Clause 4 that it was just to sort of say, okay, we're now living in fantasy land by retaining it. Yeah. Ed Miliband has turned around very quickly and said, we're going to change things before the facts have changed. And I admire him for that, because he could so easily have sort of hunkered down and waited for the scandal to blow over, as these things often do.
Absolutely, particularly when you're going into the summer and people stop thinking about it. So I completely agree. I thought it was a really bold, really bold move. And hopefully one that will pay dividends, if not money.
Yeah, maybe not money.
Okay, well, I think we're going to have to wrap it up there, because I know you've got somewhere else to be. But thank you very, very much. If you have one last word of advice, if you were able to say one thing to David Cameron to help him win the next election and your bet, what would it be?
Oh, gosh. I think probably listening to David Skelton's campaign group, reading the renewal pamphlet that was published this week. There are some really interesting essays in there. And he loves Policy Exchange, which is where David Skelton's come from. Mm. So I wouldn't be surprised if they took a lot of things on board. But there are some challenging questions in that pamphlet. And if he doesn't shy away from those questions, they're the sort of questions that a leader in opposition could talk about with greater ease. The sort of, the sort of hug a hoodie style stuff. But actually, there's sort of, we need to hug the minimum wage a little bit more and that sort of thing. And if he just reads that, I think the way the Tories communicate and the things that they think about will become more nuanced, and I think that would be a good thing.
Great. Okay, well, thank you ever so much for joining me today, Isabel.
Thank you. A pleasure.
I'll let you know when this is due to come out.
Cool.
It will be sometime over the summer.
Cool.
And I'd just like to thank you for joining me today, and also to thank Audio Boo for hosting, and Kevin McLeod at Incomputech.com for our funky theme music.